Hey, crack addicts, or cracked addicts, I'm not sure what we call you. I wanted to talk to you all about Big Grande's Teacher's Lounge. This is a hilarious improv comedy show, and it's back on Stitcher Premium for Season 3, this time releasing weekly. To celebrate the launch of this new weekly show, they're releasing Season 1 of Big Grande Teacher's Lounge for free! If you haven't heard the show yet, Big Grande, Drew Carver, Dan Lippert, John Mackey, and Ryan Rosenberg takes you inside the minds of the teachers at Hamilton High School's Honors Department. This season, they're going to welcome guests like Jessica McKenna, Paul F. Tompkins, musician Ellie King, and other people who are famous and or not famous, but who are funny. And the AV Club says it's pretty good, and the AV Club will never lie to you. So right now, y'all cracked addicts, can listen to Big Grande's Teacher's Lounge Season 1 completely free on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Earwolf.com, or if you find me, I will put it on my phone and we can sit next to each other and listen to it from my phone speakers. And if you want more, you can head to Stitcher Premium for the weekly release of Season 3. Go to stitcherpremium.com/teacher and use promo code PERSONAL to get your first month of premium for free.
He made money off of me from turning tricks. He made money off of me from the pornography. But, like, I had to sign the contract for the pornography. Like, so, I mean, to the producers, they were giving me the check and I was giving him the money. Because if I didn't, he would beat me.
I'm Brandon Johnson, and this is Cracked Gets Personal, the show where we talk to people who have lived through some of the craziest shit imaginable. Case in point, both of our sources today are human trafficking victims, basically modern-day slaves. They were forced to work without pay as prostitutes and garment workers, respectively. This happened in the United States, right under all of our noses, and it's still happening today to who knows how many people. Here to introduce our sources is my co-host Robert Evans, head of Cracked's personal experience article section.
Thanks, Brandon. Cracked's been on the human beings are being trafficked all around us without anyone realizing it beat for a couple of years now. And the two women we're hearing from today have, bar none, some of the wildest stories I've ever heard. So, the International Labor Organization estimates nearly 21 million people worldwide are held in forced labor of some sort. 4.5 million of those people are some kind of sex slave, forced into prostitution against their will, basically. The FBI claims human sex trafficking is the third largest illegal business in the world, which means that whether you're living in the Pacific Palisades, downtown Basra, Detroit, or London, there are women like Aisha being held and forced into prostitution against their will somewhere near you.
My name is Aisha, and I was trafficked sexually. Well, the abuse started when I was like 11 or 12, and the trafficking started at like 13, 14. And it went on until my 25th birthday.
Most of the media coverage on modern slavery, human trafficking, whatever you choose to call it, we can, I guess, have a talk about which of those terms is more appropriate, but it's people being forced to do labor against their will and not being compensated for it. Most of the coverage on that issue focuses entirely on women like Aisha, young, white, Western women who have been sort of forced into prostitution. But that is less than half of the story. Most of those 21 million human trafficking victims are people like Flor Molina.
My name is Flor Molina, and I'm a labor trafficking survivor in the sewing industry.
So I think probably the biggest modern touchstone for sex trafficking is the movie Taken, which makes the whole industry look like the work of cunning evil Arabs. But that's just racist garbage and beautiful throat punching. The reality is often a lot less like a international industry thing and way more like just a single creepy older man mentally abusing a young woman, which is what happened to Aisha.
So I was in basically like an extracurricular program. It was like a military-based extracurricular program because when I was younger, I wanted to go into the Navy. And I eventually wasn't able to because of I have some disabilities, but anyway, so I was in this program, and the guy who ran the program, he was the one that kind of, like, groomed me, and eventually, like, it turned sexual when I was, like, 12, and then from there, he started, like, pimping me out, and then eventually got into, like, pornography and stuff like that. So it started, the trafficking started when I was in seventh grade, which would have been around 2000, 2001. By then, he was already like sexually abusing me. And then the prostitution would have started around 2002. and the pornography was 2006, probably, because that was like my second year of college. And then I got away from him in December of 2012.
Yeah, you notice how the industry changes, that they start out on the streets, and then as pornography becomes more accessible to the masses, they make these women adjust to the times.
Yeah, and notice how also how much harder it is to fight something like that. Like, if it looks more traditionally, like, I guess what makes sex trafficking more difficult than, like, straight-up slavery to fight is that if somebody's just abducting women and putting them in a brothel and forcing them to work against their will chained to a bed, like, you break in there and you see the chains, and it's pretty easy to realize, oh, what's going on? Well, we just need to get Liam Neeson down here to just start punching people. But when it's people who are emotionally locked to their abuser, like, that's what makes it difficult, is they're not... This isn't just somebody holding them against their will with a chain. It's somebody holding them against their will via sort of years of emotional abuse, which is why they started with these girls as children.
Also, they seem to be picking a different kind of woman. You listen to the tone and the pitch of her voice, and she doesn't sound like what you think someone involved in the sex industry sounds like. It used to be, I think, that you'd listen to a prostitute and you could tell there was a lack of education and a lack of options. But this girl sounds, she said, my sophomore year of college. Mm-hmm. And that's not something I think that always went on. That's probably the new face as well.
Yeah. And so when you talk about how you can make someone like this work for you in that regard, how you can actually, like, traffic a woman who has options, who can go to the police if she wants, it's about that emotional grooming. Most sex trafficking in this part of the world, in the United States, is the result of grooming rather than abducting girls from fancy French apartments. I keep going back to the Taken well.
I mean, look, we all want to live in a fancy French apartment.
I'm not after seeing Taken.
And they specifically seek you out because you're that person that doesn't get that elsewhere, and so they can give that to you, and that sort of binds you to them. And it's very shameful to talk about because, at least for me, like, in a lot of ways, the fact that it started that way makes me feel like it was my fault. I mean, I know, like, logically it wasn't my fault, but for a long time I've hid this from people for 13 years, and I literally lived a double life because in the beginning he made me feel like I loved him and all of these things, and so I felt like I brought it on myself, basically. So I just wanted to get that out of the way because I think that when you talk about grooming, like, realizing that shame that I think a lot of people carry is really important. I mean, he would, like, say nice things to me and, you know, stuff like that. I mean, even before, but I just remember, like, one time I was sitting in the break room and he came in and I was, like, dancing or something, and he, like, commented on how attractive I was, I think. And from there, I guess it sort of intrigued me that he would make a comment like that. So I followed him down the hallway. And I mean, this was a man that was 35 years older than me. So he was in his late 40s when it started and close to 60, I think, by the time that it was ending.
Yeah. And so that's how it started in her case, was some compliments. Finding a girl who didn't have sort of a strong older male figure in her life, and just offering her that to start, like talking to her like an adult, which was, I think, a big thing for her, just having someone like reach out to her like she was an adult, which obviously, as adults, we're like, oh, that's kind of messed up. You can't talk to 12-year-old girls like they're adult women, because that's just, oof.
Right, but part of being a predator, obviously, is objectifying in a way that makes these women a piece of property, and then that's the next logical step. We used to think of it as you get off a Greyhound, you go to the bus stop, there's a guy who looks like a pimp at the bus stop. He's got, you know, fish in his high heel boots, and he pulls you into a life of prostitution that you don't even consider. But what I'm hearing her say is that this is a really bad relationship.
Yeah.
Started at an awkward time in my life, and I wound up doing these things because I felt more like I was in a bad relationship than a person who was actually being prostituted.
Like when you're 12, 13 years old, what is it you want more than anything else? Is to be like an adult, is to be treated like an adult. And so when an adult offers you that, it's pretty, like you said, you get intrigued.
Yeah.
And Aisha's experience kind of gradually escalated from creepy and illegally older boyfriend to pimp. It was almost shocking how fast it happened.
And in the beginning, you know, it was almost like he was my boyfriend and we were in love and whatever. And when he started getting me to turn tricks for him, or even just, this is really hard to describe, but like to be the fantasy that he wanted. There were times when like he would want me to do things that I wasn't comfortable doing. And eventually like he was very into S&M. So like this would turn into like beatings that went beyond like what I was comfortable with sexually and like just things like that. But I wanted to do it to make him happy, but also like it just meant completely denying my own comfort and my own safety and all of those things.
And, you know, eventually he started asking her to fuck other men for his profit. And the question I think most people hear when they hear that story is how didn't her parents know? And that's kind of the important next ingredient to this story is we imagine, you know, a girl's parents would immediately learn about what was happening and sort of throat punch their way to a solution. But everybody doesn't have that kind of family background.
Right. I mean, growing up, like, my parents divorced when I was really young, and, you know, my dad was pretty much absent. My mom was a great mom, but, I mean, I was a teenager. Like, you know, all parents and children don't have a good time communicating. My mom worked a lot, and I was a latchkey kid, and none of these are excuses for why any of this was acceptable, but it makes, and looking back now, I was the poster child for, like, the target for a trafficker. Like, I would make pedophiles like salivate, you know, like I was the perfect victim. And so I also like had a lot of depression and anxiety and stuff like that, which of course got a lot worse as it went on. And my family didn't really understand that, like my mom and my sister or who I was closest to, and they just couldn't like comprehend what I was going through. So this was one more thing that they just didn't get.
It's also worth noting that this guy, like when you picture this guy, like you said, you picture either the stereotypical pimp or, I don't know, like an unholy cross between Gargamel and the guy from Jethro Tull's Aqualung. But this dude didn't look like that.
No, he looked Ned Flanders-y.
Yeah. I mean, he looked like a cop, actually.
It's absolutely like not like we're locked up in a room and the ties are more emotional. But at the same time, my trafficker is a law enforcement officer and he's, you know, a card-carrying NRA member that owns his own arsenal.
It's a lot scarier to be sort of put in that position by that guy than somebody who anybody can look at and be like, oh, yeah, there's something going on wrong with that fellow. There's got to be some ladies chained up in the basement of his house. Like,
yeah, if a cop is pimping you out, then if anything should happen to you and you feel like you're going to go to a doctor's office, you must think, man, what do doctors really do? You wouldn't trust a teacher at
yeah.
that point. If a cop pimped you out, you wouldn't trust a teacher or a doctor or a nun or a priest.
Well, yeah, especially since this guy was essentially a teacher cop. Like, she met him at an ROTC style sort of class. Like, he was in sort of the perfect position to do this. One of the things that I think was really interesting about her case is that her trafficker was able to use kind of that inherent desire all kids have to act more adult against her. Like, he framed this, as she said, as sort of a cool adult kinky BDSM relationship.
I think it was that, like, I had bought into the idea of, like, us in this, like, master-slave relationship right by the time I was 13 or 14. So at that point, me doing that for him was, like, me being a good submissive. Like, I don't know how familiar you are with BDSM, but, like, what was going on was absolutely not BDSM in any way, shape, or form. But at the time, that's how I thought of it. That's how he made it sound. And it seemed like this great, noble thing to be, like, submissive and to be serving someone else because I'm a caretaker. Like, naturally, that's my... I don't know, honestly, I don't know how much that was my personality before this happened, but, like, that's absolutely been my personality ever since.
So I think that sort of paints this in an important light, that this human trafficking doesn't look the way you'd expect because it's not wrapped in that package. Like, the best way to traffic someone isn't to let them know, like, you're in this position and you can't leave and you have to do this. The best way is to make them feel like this is something you want to do for me. Like, this is a good thing for you to be doing.
You're on a road trip with your family and you look over and you see a station wagon with a dad with four of his daughters in the car and you think, wow, that's a great dad. And really what you're looking at potentially is a criminal operation because I think they've changed the way that they do things. They move into neighborhoods and you think, oh, this is a family that fosters children. And how cool is it that girls come and go out of this house and nobody's really paying attention to it. But in America, we have an epidemic of guys who have gotten into this line of work and been able to disguise it.
Yeah, and it's really kind of, I hate saying like it's Hollywood's fault about stuff, but it certainly can't help that like we all have this image in our head of what a pimp looks like, what a trafficker looks like. And it's never this dude. It's never like some clean-cut former military police officer fellow like walking around a school building as like a member of the community in good standing. Like there's somebody on the fringe of society. But Why would you be on the fringe of the society and do this job when you can be in its guts?
All up in its guts.
All up in its
and
guts.
And the clientele also wishes to remain discreet. So they want to deal with somebody who looks like they're dropping a kid off to be the babysitter for the evening. Also, it would help if, like, Julia Roberts didn't get a necklace in Pretty Woman and suddenly decide to go from amateur prostitute to professional prostitute wife style. So we have this idea in America that a prostitute deserves it, that this is a person who has made a choice to do this, when we know deep down nobody likes to give anything away for free, not even a handshake.
Well, I don't think most of their customers know. I don't think most of the people who pay for sex from trafficked women, as opposed to like prostitutes, who are like, no, I just want to get into whoring. Like, that's like my gig. Like, there's plenty of people who want to be sex workers. And I think it's easy to tell yourself the lie if you're using someone who doesn't want to be using a sex worker. Like, you make a lot more money as a trafficker if you don't present your client as someone who's doing it against their will. Like,
right.
Your customers should never know that, which is part of what makes it tougher. Like, you hear about all these Johns getting busted, and it's like, how many of them knew what they were participating in? And I guess the point is that they probably didn't care enough to check, but how do you vet that?
It's the strip club rule, which is, inside of a strip club, we believe that we should be able to pay for whatever we want. And then when we walk out of the strip club, we would be aghast if somebody suggested that we pay for whatever we want. And when somebody says, I got ripped off at a strip club for 30 grand, they charge my credit card, everybody in society goes, well, that's what you get for thinking you could buy it in the first place. But it's obviously something we all think we should be able to buy, or there would be no strip clubs.
I've talked to CEO of the Polaris Foundation, which is a big anti-trafficking organization, and they're all pretty anti-prostitution, like anti-legal prostitution, because their line is like, you can't separate the two. Like, you can't, there's no way to know, and if it's legal, then people will just traffic women and have an easier time of it because you won't be able to bust them. But I don't, like, I have trouble believing that the solution can be that black and white, because if you just say all prostitution's illegal, well, then that's the situation we still have in most of the country, and clearly sex trafficking's still a problem.
I think that what you do, though, is you make it so that the incentive to be a prostitute is no better than the incentive to be, say, a salesperson at the Gap. And then you get women who are able to choose. They can do this job or they don't have to do this job. But right now, because of the way we're doing it, it requires a great deal of illegality for anybody to turn a profit.
Yeah, and that illegality is a shield to people like this guy, because then there's, you know, for one thing, like, if she'd gotten busted at any point where she was turning tricks, if he wasn't caught during the bust, well, what are the odds she was going to turn this guy in, this guy who she considered for most of this period of time to be like her boyfriend? Like, he could have gotten off scot-free. And I think they generally do.
Of course, because there's no paper trail.
Yeah.
It's all cash. And someone can say, this person is my pimp. But can you imagine somebody being like, this person's my pimp, to somebody who's A, not their pimp, or that a pimp would go, actually, you're right, I have been a pimp. And she's right. I'm glad you guys brought her back to me. You know, so these dudes just pretty much walk away. They don't go after the pimps as much. And
yeah.
They should. It almost seems to me like the people who use the services are also victims, in that A, they've been led to believe that this was okay without them knowing. And I believe that there might be some sexual abuse that has occurred on the part of a John. Because when you're willing to allow someone else to be sold, it's probably an experience that you have had yourself.
That's an interesting point. I think a lot of people are intrigued by the idea of like just being able to like go to Amsterdam and pay for a prostitute and be able to do it nice and safe and legal. And I think everybody wants to pretend that that's what's happening. Like, even if it's in a situation where it's like, oh boy, this there's clearly some signs that this woman isn't choosing to be here.
However, you got to ask the question of what type of person has that hard of a time procuring consensual sex. There might be some damage there. So I think possibly the larger way to fight the situation is to also ask, why do we have so many customers, not so many prostitutes, not so many Johns? I mean, not so many pimps. You have to ask yourself, wow, we have a lot of customers for this product, despite the fact that this product is not the best way to experience this product.
I think it is important to point out that, like, from the perspective of these Johns, someone can be, well, not just these Johns, but all the people who were in Aisha's life, someone can be trafficked against their will, and their life can look very normal on the surface to everybody around them.
But the whole time that this was going on, I mean, I went to school, I made good grades.
But she was still very much being trafficked, and in more than one way. Once Aisha turned 18, her trafficker was really able to cash in by getting her involved in the porn industry.
So he was definitely making money off of it. He had control over my bank accounts. He had control over where I live. he would have me take out loans and, like, give the money to him, because I could take out student loans at the time. So, like, I'm still paying that back. Those types of things that, because I never press charges against him, there's no proof that I have that it's not my debt. So, I have debt that's essentially his. He made money off of me from turning tricks. He made money off of me from the pornography. But, like, I had to sign the contract for the pornography. Like, so, I mean, to the producers, they were giving me the check and I was giving him the money, because if I didn't, he would beat me. Like, but they had no way of knowing that.
And when did you start with the pornography? Like, what age were you when sort of that aspect of this began?
So I started getting into pornography when I was like 18 or 19. So the prostitution, it had happened. It had started when I was younger, and then the pornography when I was older. I mean, he would take pictures and videos of me when I was younger and, you know, send them to his buddies, and he had friends that trafficked girls. And so he did do his own sort of like home media amateur pornography when I was younger. But the actual like camming and like pornography, like you can literally see videos of me on mainstream pornography sites, happened when I was older.
Yeah. So it's the same problem. Like if you're a porn producer, what do you do in that situation? How do you even know? Like, cause you can add, like you're handing them the check. Like you can't blame them for this, but I guess maybe you can blame all of us a little bit for there just being a situation in our society where nobody would catch on to this, or where she wouldn't know she has somewhere to go. Like, what do you do? Like,
I mean, I've been watching porn all my life, and it is the craziest thing, because I remember when teen was the selling point. Whether you like pornography or not, I don't care. But I think we can all agree that that was a weird day in porn, in that you search teen, or the site builds itself on being teen porn. I thought there were these times where it's, even as a person who cooked food for a living, I knew if I saw an old piece of chicken, I could probably cook it up in a way that you'd eat it, but you going home and getting sick was not what I was interested in, even though you'd be far, far from the restaurant. In this situation, we needed a little bit of ethics to say, we're not even gonna use the word teen and porn in the same sentence. And yet, as soon as we introduced that word, people didn't question it, they used it, they jumped on the bandwagon, and they actually sought out, instead of using actresses that were young looking, they actually sought out teens. And that's crazy.
Yeah, because it's like one thing, like, of course, legally, like an 18-year-old, you can join the army, so why wouldn't you be able to be in porn? But also, like, if you're advertising that your porn is teenage girls, how is that not going to make it more likely that shit like this goes down?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I guess I'm asking, like, who do we arrest? Is it all of us?
Certainly got to change the language. And we say, look, I'm going to let, it's the same way we kind of do with gun manufacturers, which is like, I'm going to let you make something that could possibly kill me if somebody picked it up accidentally and randomly. But we got to make it harder for this item to be made and distributed. So with teen porn, I think we have the right to ask industries, just like we asked United. I think we have the right to ask an industry, have some ethics, have some morals, vet it. We'll still buy your product. We love your product. But if you found out that McDonald's had cleverly been sneaking you wood chips for the past 20 years, you'd be outraged. And if you knew that your porn was actually containing teens who were being filmed against their will, not just the byline, I think we'd also be outraged.
Yeah, but I guess what makes it tougher is that the pornographers, in this case, these producers, didn't know, or at least had you could make a reasonable argument that most of them didn't know, because her trafficker was using her adulthood as basically a shield. I mean, at this point, she was pretty habituated to following his orders, and you can't stop an 18-year-old, a 19-year-old from doing whatever the hell they want to do, as long as it's not buying alcohol or a gun.
But have you ever seen an 18-year-old in a comedy club without an adult?
No.
Because even though you're a comedian and you're funny at 16, you're not allowed to perform in a bar unless you have an adult with you. And even Dave Chappelle, who started at 15, had to have his mother. Amy Schumer started really early. She had to have her mother with her. And when people went on tour and they were kids, they also had to have a parent. We know how to police the safety of children. We have just chosen not to.
Oh, that's a really interesting point. Why shouldn't porn be as regulated as stand-up comedy?
There's a thing called a Coogan account. And a Coogan account is from an actor, Jackie Coogan, whose parents ripped him off. And it's from the 30s. So even in the 30s, we knew that children could get exploited. And we didn't want two jerks to walk away with their money, in this case being his parents. They could do the same thing for porn. Or if you're paying out, you need to pay to her. Even if the account has his name on it, you need to pay to her. We know how to do that stuff.
That's a really good point.
Read all these tips in my new book, Porn. You can make this on the cheap and do the right thing, y'all.
Oh boy, let's just roll that next clip. I was trying to segue directly into it, but we'll just launch.
Initially, when I was legally an adult and we were sort of presenting it as a relationship to my friends, and I would talk about some of the stuff that he did, like, people knew that I did pornography. Even like my family knew that, but it was like presented as like my choice, and so they didn't really question it that much, I guess. Because honestly, like, I've never lied about anything in my life the way that I lied about this. Like, I lied so well about this that I should probably get an Oscar for, like, acting, because nobody really questioned it, even though, like, he was that much older than me. And I did a lot of reassuring and a lot of, oh, yeah, it's no problem. Like, I really want to do it. You know, I really enjoy it. It's really empowering, this, that, and the other, that nobody said anything.
Yeah, I feel like we can't emphasize the emotional dimension enough here. This guy was able to traffic Aisha at first because he listened to her, he understood her life, and so he was able to, like, empathize with her and build trust with her. And as a result, like, she went to bat for him.
And that's because my dad was, like, it was just a situation where, like, my dad could not give me what I needed from him. And, like, now I can psychologically analyze this and tell you that that's what was happening. But at the time, all I knew was that I needed to, like, make someone happy and have someone be pleased with me, and this was the way that I could do it. And that I, like, had this sort of fundamental belief that if I wasn't doing that, then I was, like, a bad person, or, like, I was basically, like, worthless. And so I think that framing it that way and playing on that need that I had to be useful to someone and to be loved and to be needed really was the easiest way for him to convince me to do anything, really.
What always pisses me off about a hustle is when your hustle is bullshit. So if you're hustling somebody who's only making 68 to 73 cents on a legit dollar, then you're a jackass to me. It's like making money off of people whose houses burn down and then you sell the artifacts of whatever's left. I don't mind if people hustle. I don't mind if you come up with a way that's hand to mouth and you can get money. But when your money comes off of the backs of young, or your money comes off of vulnerability, I think there's a special place in financial hell for you.
Yeah, there ought to be. You said like 68, 73 cents on the legitimate dollar, but she wasn't making any money off of this. Like, he was getting every dime because she cared about this guy. Like, he had his hooks in her deeper than any sort of like police or law enforcement would have been able to pry out. Like, it never occurred to her to go to the police. I mean, even though she again, as she's about to explain, she very much knew that what he was doing was against the law.
I mean, I knew that obviously it was illegal, and I knew that, you know, a lot of the stuff that he had me do, like, he tried to get me hooked on drugs. He would purposefully have me sleep with people that might have an STD. He really, like, had this fantasy about me getting pregnant and stuff like that. And so, like, I knew all of this was not normal and not safe and very abusive, but I didn't really recognize it as that serious until I started to kind of have a separate life from him. So when I graduated from college, I moved to a different state where he had ties to. So he would, like, travel back and forth. And I still was turning church for him, and I was doing porn for him and all of this. And I had to, like, be very accountable to him about where I was going. But I had some time away from him. Like, I made friends there. I had my own place that I live. I had to call him every day, which I sort of started to really get the feeling that I needed to get away from him when I started to dread calling him every day. Because I got away from him. I had friends where I moved, and I had, like, this whole different life that did revolve around him in some ways, but it didn't entirely revolve around him, and he didn't have as much control over me, and it really freaked him out that he didn't. He was very unhappy, but not unhappy enough to, like, force me to come back. I think he was afraid that if he did that, like, it would get out what had been going on.
Oh, it's amazing that this dude lacked guts. Who'd imagine that this piece of shit had no guts?
Yeah, not the guts to confront like a 21-year-old college student.
Yeah.
No, and it's interesting to me that, like, that was what started breaking the metaphorical chains. It wasn't any kind of throat punching. It wasn't any kind of police activity. It wasn't an FBI sting. It was just her liking this guy less, caring less about this guy, seeing that what he was doing was fucked up. Like, that's what it was. It was an emotional relationship that got her into this situation, and it was the fading of that emotional relationship that helped her start to break free.
Choice.
Choice.
Choice is a wonderful thing.
she didn't really take any physical steps to separate from this guy until she started going to therapy. And even then, it wasn't an overnight thing. It wasn't just saying, I'm done with this. Like, it was a process.
My depression and my anxiety were really bad. I started going to a therapist. And that was the first time that, like, I had gone to therapists before, but I had never been honest with them about the history. And I don't remember exactly how she did it, but she sort of teased out of me that, you know, something was not right. And it wasn't just that, you know, we had started dating when I was like 18 or whatever. Initially, the plan was that I would wait 6 months and try to like save away money from doing pornography and prostitution so that I could support myself if I completely like cut ties with him. But about 2 months into that plan, he came to visit, and it was just really bad. The whole visit was just horrifically awful. And so at the end of it, I was like, well, the minute that he left, I called her, and I was like, I can't do this anymore. Like, I have to get out of this now. What do I do? Like, how do I change my phone number? How do I, you know, what do I do? And so I changed my phone number, and I took out a loan, and I moved, and still in the same city, but I moved. And then after a few months of, like, I had to get legal help and everything, but I managed to change my name, which helped me feel safer and also more able to, like, speak out about it, because that way I wasn't doing it under my real name.
So that's my other question is, mm-hmm. if you are someone who's been engaged in prostitution, can you turn around and then go to the police and say, look, I have all the information you need. This guy's a pimp. I can testify against him. It's been 10 years of business.
No. I mean, and she did not. I mean, for one thing, you'd still be admitting to committing crimes. If you're an adult, and I've talked to women who were trafficked and got out of it and who work with the FBI now, and the FBI brings them in when they bust trafficking situations and they find women who are under 18. But the women who are over 18, even though they've been trafficked as well, they just get arrested. Like, that's the legal framework we have set up, because they're still prostitutes, you know.
So what you're saying is a system set up by a group of men in no way protects women who suddenly find themselves victims of men?
I know, it's the only situation like that, but try to wrap your head around that.
Having a hard time, but...
But that is the really ugly and unsatisfying coda to this story, is Aisha never reported her trafficker to the police. She's still hiding, and she's still obviously scared of him.
There's a lot of reasons I haven't pursued legal action against him. The main reason is that I know that he's armed. I know that he, you know, is perfectly capable of shooting me, and I know that he knows where my sister and her kids live because he's been there before. But no, I know that I'm 98% sure he doesn't know where I live now.
Which still aren't odds you want to gamble on. And another thing that she does know is that she wasn't the first woman that this guy trafficked.
I mean, it wasn't like an organized sort of situation where he was making gobs of money off of like different girls. I do know that he had abused and trafficked other girls before me, but as far as I know from kind of keeping tabs on him from people that I know where I used to live, I don't think that he has done it since me. I think that he probably, his health situation and just like, I mean, to put that level of energy into like grooming someone to find a willing victim to, you know what I mean? I think that's honestly more work than he probably has in him at this age. But I do know that he had, because at least he told me that he had trafficked girls before me and that he had abused girls before me.
Did he describe it as trafficking and abuse, or did he use different terms for it?
He described what he had done to other girls. Like, he had bought young prostitutes before. He had groomed other girls before in the same organization, that like the same program that I had met him through. He basically described it as like, you know, him hiring prostitutes, and as far as like the other girls, that he'd had other like young girlfriends or whatever before, and that they had turned tricks for him and they had done all this stuff for him. But he didn't describe it as trafficking, ever.
I think that the taken sort of image of, like, there being giant shadowy networks of, or of, like, what Corey Feldman believes, that there's this giant underground child prostitution network throughout all of Hollywood, those are actually, like, optimistic, comforting fantasies, because then it's easy to fight. If there's, like, some shadowy network, you bust the network and you stop the problem. But there's not one shadowy network. There's just a bunch of assholes out there abusing people on a pretty individual, small scale. But, like, there's a lot of them out there. And it's hard to fight that. Because if someone's just being locked up against their will, Well, you break them free, and then they can go about doing their thing. If somebody's like she was, there was no other person who could come in and bust her out of that. She had to bust herself out of that.
Yeah, if one pimp had six prostitutes and you busted one prostitute and that was freedom for five other girls, that would be a great story. But what you have, like you said, is these satellite operators who maybe only have one or two girls, maybe even keep them within their family so that there's never any means for them to go to the police.
Yeah, exactly. I think, actually, Aisha puts it really well here in a second.
If you research cases like this, you will see trafficking, but it won't be framed as trafficking. It'll be framed as child sexual abuse. It'll be framed as child pornography. It'll be framed as child prostitution, even though no child can legally be a prostitute. And so we as victims, those of us who've been through situations like that, we generally lose our court cases. Part of why I never press charges against him is because a similar thing happened to a seventh grader in the school that I went to. She was trafficked by our PE coach the year before he started grooming me. And once it came out, the coach did end up going to jail, but her life was completely destroyed. Everyone called her a home wrecker because he had been engaged at the time. They blamed her for it. It was horrific. Like, he did go to jail for a while, but people believed that it was her fault, that she wrecked his life by talking to the police. And all this, so I honestly believe that if I had ever pressed charges against him, that would have been me. Like, that's how it would have been talked about. And so I think that stigma really keeps people from speaking up and from pressing charges.
It's always the gym teachers.
It's always the gym teachers, man. Yeah.
Or the ROTC teachers.
But I mean, it's usually the French and the Spanish teachers, too, let's be honest. All the foreign language teachers, mm-hmm. you know, they always have a separate set of eyes.
Well, you know, it's like I said, if you're trying to teach kids a foreign language, you're probably trying to teach them something else inappropriate.
That's right. Your
kids don't need foreign languages.
It starts out as Spanish and it winds up being the Lumbata. Come on, man.
Jesus Christ, Brandon. You might have heard, it was kind of big news a few months ago, that Los Angeles authorities just arrested like 500 people for purchasing child and adult sex trafficking victims. 28 of those people who were arrested were pimps. And it was a big news story because sex trafficking is nearly always a big news story. Some of Cracked's biggest hit articles have been like us just talking with individual victims of sex trafficking because it's fascinating and it's gruesome and it's something people want to like. It's like that accident on the side of the highway where you can see the body under the white sheet. Like, everybody's got to crane their neck to look at it. But there's a danger to that, too, because it sort of gets sensationalized. And I think that it's also caused a little bit of a backlash, particularly from, like, sex workers' advocacy groups, because they feel like a lot of anti-trafficking charities have basically turned into fronts for movements to keep sex work criminalized. And the idea is that since these groups don't get much traction by crusading against prostitution, they use the issue of human trafficking as sort of like camouflage to attack sex work.
I'm just going to read this quote here from a 2014 Washington Post article written by Maggie McNeil called Lies, Damn Lies, and Sex Work Statistics.
This sort of statistical malpractice has always been typical of prostitution research, but the incentive to produce it has dramatically increased in the past decade thanks to a media-focused moral panic over sex trafficking. Sex work prohibitionists have long seen trafficking and sex slavery as a useful Trojan horse. In its 2010 National Action Plan, for example, the activist group Demand Abolition writes, framing the campaign's key target as sexual slavery might garner more support and less resistance, while framing the campaign as combating prostitution may be less likely to mobilize similar levels of support and to stimulate stronger opposition. Which is pretty messed up.
Well, it's hard to be a liberal and talk about the advancement of women and then turn around and look at the statistics for prostitution. So for the left, it's a black eye. Mm-hmm. They keep saying, we are doing these things, we are championing these causes, and then they look over and there are still prostitutes and victims, and the narrative doesn't match. So even if you're trying to fight for women's rights and you're saying there's more in business and there's more in government and there's more in the decision-making aspect, but then there are people walking down the street trying to earn a dollar as a woman, it's a blemish. So yeah. While we all want to do something about it, the way we want to do something about it is very different. And the people who want to help the most sometimes wind up, I think, making it look more stigmatized.
Part of what I have trouble with, just kind of on a moral comfort level, is how much more focus. You know, you've got 21 million victims of human trafficking in the world is the estimate. 4.5 million of them are being sex trafficked. Well, that leaves, what, like 16 million labor trafficking victims. And we don't hear about that often. And I brought this up when I spoke with the CEO of the Polaris Foundation.
he's anti-legal prostitution as well, but he agreed that there's a lot less focus on labor trafficking than there should be. There's a lot less, you hear a lot less from victims of labor trafficking than you should, because it's a couple of reasons. One is that it's not as terrifying a story, because sex trafficking is a story of rape, and rape is you know, gruesome and awful, but also like something people pay attention to. It's easy to make like a big lurid red headline about that. Labor trafficking is really bad too, but it's also like, that's how you get your shoes, man. Like,
it's also per job.
Yeah.
We're on this stadium and then the stadium moves. Mm-hmm. We're on this high rise development and then it's built. So you don't have people who are being trafficked from job to job to job to job to job all the time. Sometimes it's just a job.
Yeah. And I think it's important to kind of use this to lead into talking with Floor, because our second source for today was labor traffic in the sewing industry. And her experience isn't one that we like that gets as much traction if you don't sort of pair it with a lurid story of sex trafficking. I think it's really important to talk about, because labor trafficking survivors like Floor are the people who make, you know, our clothes and shit.
Yeah, I do remember three big department stores in the United States. One is Macy's, the other one is JCPenney, and the other one is Sears.
Floor's journey into slavery started with the search for a job, which sounds more like a radical anti-capitalist rant than it actually is, but only, like, slightly.
I was contacted by my sewing teacher, because back then I was taking sewing classes, and my sewing teacher was contacted by a trafficker, because she knew a lot of women. And my sewing teacher told me about the great opportunity to go to the United States. I didn't have to worry about paying or any expenses at the moment. Everything was paid for. When I get to the United States, I will have a place where to stay. I will have a job, and everything seemed to be nice. So I took the opportunity to come to the United States, and it's where my nightmare started.
Floor was smuggled into the U.S. via Mexico by coyotes. But she expected all that. Like, that was part of the plan. You know, you're going to come to the United States, you're going to get smuggled in. What she didn't expect was to have her documents seized upon arrival and essentially be forced to live in a factory.
I realized that was the wrong decision, the wrong turn, when I arrived in Tijuana. And when my trafficker asked me for my documents, I felt that something was wrong. I couldn't tell exactly what it was, especially that she asked me for my documents. She said that for my safety, it was better that she kept my documents. That situation just made me feel that something was wrong. And when I arrived to Los Angeles, my trafficker told me that now I owe her almost $3,000. For bringing me over, and now I have to work for her because now I have a huge debt with her and I must work in order to pay my debt.
Floor wasn't kept locked in chain in a room. Her chains, in this case, rather than being like emotional, were the threat of the American police, because again, she was here illegally.
So you're telling me I can leave at any time?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
I probably should have respond to that, yeah, with something funny. No, but it is like you think about like what a perfect situation that is for the trafficker, because for one thing, it's really easy. You come to the United States from Mexico, you're smuggled into the country. If somebody wants to tell you a bunch of awful stories of what the police will do if they catch you, like, you'll believe it. Even though here in LA, at least, like, the LAPD doesn't give a shit. Like, they're not gonna, see that you're undocumented and like throw you, like, even right now. Like, maybe if you run into an ICE agent, like, you're going to be in some trouble, but not the LAPD.
Which would have helped her, actually, yeah, to run into an ICE agent and then get sent back home where she could start, yeah, all over again.
It would have still been better, but she was told that she was going to go. Well, she'll tell you what she was told.
She also told me that I'm not allowed to talk to anybody. I'm not allowed to go outside. I'm supposed to stay inside, because if I go outside, I put her in danger. And also, the police will put me in jail because I'm here illegally. I have no documents, no identity. Nobody will care about me. And if the police put me in jail, I will never see my children again. And she said also, if I do anything to put her in danger, she knew where my family was. She knew where my children were. And I didn't want to put them in danger. So I thought that was really, really, those were really strong words. And of course, I didn't want to put my children at risk. And of course, I did everything she said, not to talk to anybody, never went outside because I wasn't allowed. She had a crew of women who monitored my movements during the business hours.
That business, again, was making all of your clothes.
I was in a factory. The factory had like 60 sewing machines. The first 3 days, I went back and forth to her house and came in to work to the factory. But after 3 days, my trafficker and her crew decided that I was supposed to sleep in the shop because the time I was using going and coming back, I was wasting that time, and that was her time. So the more time I worked, the faster I would pay my debt.
But yeah, I mean, of course, the debt never gets paid right until they're done using you.
And the reason that your clothes are falling apart is not because they're cheap, but because they're made by people who are under great stress and duress. That they probably would have lasted longer and been sewn correctly if these people were being paid well. But because these people were being paid very little that they have to give away while they worry about their children, you're going to be missing some buttons. Some seams are going to be crooked. I love that Sears and JCPenney are doing very badly. I know that they're closing most of their stores. So it does seem like there's some karma in the universe. But I hate that at the last minute, their last financial gasp was to enslave people.
Or at least to stop caring so much about where their clothing came from.
Yeah.
There's a website you can go to that you'll enter into like the things you like to buy, what you purchase on a yearly basis, and it'll tell you roughly how many slaves. Because it's like these phones in our hands, like there's minerals in them. Like they're not put together by slaves because those people in China, like it's a shit job, but it's a job you choose to get.
It's a shit job.
It is a shit
job. They're pretty slaved. They're like tend to a cage.
Well, it depends. Like the Foxconn plant, it's a shit job, but it's also like a shit job that is in high demand. A lot of people apply for that thing, as opposed to like the minerals in here, which are mined in like Ghana and places by people who legitimately have like an AK-47 at the, like the old style
I call them blood batteries.
Yeah.
Because they're like blood diamonds for all you Prius drivers who want to brag about your Prius driving. Guess what, rich people? Real nice.
No, I put real blood in my Prius.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, no, there's...
I use kitten ears. Mm-hmm. It's very costly, but it's so cute. Just loading up my tank.
Well, that leads naturally into this next part. I really can't think of anyone who's in much more of a fucked position in this country than having to choose between like going to the police and admitting that you're here illegally and committing a crime or continuing to work against your will in a factory.
The truth is, if she had shown up someplace with no ID, we would have been interested. That's the most interesting thing you can do in the United States, is that she was told, if you show up here and you've got no ID and they can't verify your identity, then you're going to be in trouble, when the reality is, we would be very interested in you. We would work on trying to get you back to wherever you belong. Apparel's a dirty industry.
Yeah, garments aren't coming along looking well in this.
No, and there are people who get it right, but you want to look at the tags, and you can tell. If something comes from Jamaica, it's probably not as trafficked as things that are coming out of, like, Romania and Mauritania and countries that you've never heard of, because that's the place that you would try and run an illegal operation to make velvet blazers for $6.
But Ania, you want to look for that at the end of the country name. If that's somewhere along in the production line, then there might be a problem.
If you've never heard of Bluxglakistan, you probably shouldn't be buying shirts from there.
Good God, Bluxglakistan.
Yeah, Bluxglakistan.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. It's right. Where we make delicious dumpling.
Let's talk a little bit about what the working conditions were like.
The factory didn't have a place where to sleep. I had to sleep in a little storage room, and I shared the mattress with my sewing teacher, who was also in the same situation as I was. The factory didn't have a shower. I wasn't, as I said, I wasn't allowed to put one step out of the shop. I wasn't allowed to talk to my coworkers. And all this time, I hadn't contacted my family, so my family thought I had forgotten about them because they didn't know whether I crossed the border or not or where I was. So my family thought I had forgotten about my mother and my children. They often abused me physically, pulling my hair, pinching me, slapping me, all the time telling me demeaning words, making me feel bad about my origin. And all the time treating me about the police, about the authorities, all the time telling me that if I go outside and if I talk to anybody, nobody will believe me. Instead, they will put me in jail. And of course, I was so afraid of the police because I was so new to this country. I didn't know where I was. I didn't know who to talk to or who to ask for help. And I had no money, no English. I hadn't ever been to this country, so I didn't know anything about the United States, and I was really, really afraid if I do anything and whatever I did put my children in danger. So I was in this bad situation because I had to work 18 to 20 hours a day, 7 days a week, And during the these long hours that I worked, I have multiple chores, sewing, ironing, putting the dresses into the right size, putting labels onto the dresses, moving them to the proper racks. And when the trucks came, I had to unload the trucks with the fabric they brought to make the dresses. And then when the trucks were empty, I loaded them with the dresses that were ready to go to the store. And I got, during these long hours that I worked, I had only 10 minutes to eat beans and rice, and the fastest I could, because all the time they remind me that I'm here for work, and I'm supposed to be working, not wasting the time eating or sharing or, you know, taking a break. So I got sick, and I asked to see a doctor, but my trafficker said no, because I have no money. And she made me feel about me feeling sick. Instead, I got punished. She slapped me in front of my coworkers and said that she's punishing me because I have spoken when I'm not supposed to. Because I asked one of my coworkers if she knew how to go to see a doctor, and my trafficker said no, because I have no money. And ever since, my punishment got worse, because she said that I had disobeyed and I have put her in danger. And she said, you don't want to put your children at risk. I already told you. I already warned you. But I said, I am sick, and all I did is ask to see a doctor. I'm not asking for anything. I just need to see a doctor because I'm sick. But instead of letting me go to see a doctor, she punished me.
See that, how that's like a common thread between both of these stories? It's just that the most effective way to keep someone doing your bidding is to make them feel like they don't have any other options. Like there's no way out. There's no one they can go to.
And that bad business people make bad business decisions, because we know that the biggest corporations have wellness retreats.
Yeah.
They have places where you can actually go reset yourself, where you can have apple infused water while somebody rubs your feet and plays you Enya. Whereas these people are at the lower end of good business. So they get none of that. And the product reflects that. That's why it's ridiculous, is that this isn't a zero sum game. You're never going to get anything that gets you to be financially more stable, because the way you're going about business is actually expensive.
Think of the effort that's necessary to, like,
Break a person.
Yeah, keep them too scared to leave, to, like, physically abuse them, as opposed to just, like, this is a woman who wanted to sew. Like, she was...
Right,
yeah, exactly.
Right.
Like, she wanted to be doing this.
And she was clearly one of the better ones, mm-hmm. because she was doing it happily. And that's why they wanted her to come over here in the first place.
Yeah, I feel like it must have been, I mean, maybe you still got to get her over the border illegally. Like, I understand that that's expensive, but
you don't. I mean, when you want to immigrate, if you can prove that this person has a skill that cannot be done in the country that you're in, you have the right to get them a visa.
Get them an H-1B.
That's right. But yeah, there is a constant abuse aspect to it all.
It's a lot of work.
Yep.
It's different kind of work than you'd expect. It's not a matter of finding a secure place for them. It's not a matter of locking up. It's a matter of making them feel like they're locked in their own heads.
Yeah, it's little man work. I mean, quite honestly, it's not as profitable as working a regular job. I know that.
No, that's why I've got to think that a lot of these people really like what they're doing.
Yep.
Like the traffickers. Like, yeah. It has to be a passion.
Sociopaths.
Or something weirder.
Narcissists. Any of the things that can occur in your brain that make you suddenly go for yours in spite of everyone else's wishes, this is a perfect field for these people to go into. Yeah. Because it doesn't make financial sense. And it doesn't make ethical or moral sense. But it does make sense if your ego is entrapped.
Yeah, it can make emotional sense.
Mm-hmm. Emotional sense is also my new fragrance.
So yeah, Floor's kind of path out of this hellhole she found herself in was actually just consistency. You know, before she left the country, she made a promise to her family and a promise to God that she was going to, you know, visit him at a church as soon as she'd arrive. Because obviously crossing the desert, that's dangerous. Like, mm-hmm. it's well, sailors have done that for fucking ever. Like, as soon as I get across the ocean, I'm gonna go sacrifice at the Temple of Poseidon or whatnot. I'm getting off topic. The point is that Flora kept begging her trafficker for a trip to church after she arrived.
I insisted about asking her to let me go to a church, even though I haven't ever been outside. I still insisted. She said that I have to earn the permission to go to a church. She gave me more load of work, and when I proved that I really, really wanted to go to a church, she said, why do you want to go to a church? You are a bad person. And I said, that's why I want to go and ask God to change my heart. And I think I was so insistent that she got tired of my insistence. So finally, she let me go to a church. So that Sunday when I walked through the parking lot and I realized that I was free, because that Sunday, to my surprise, nobody was monitoring my movements. Nobody was there. So I walked through the parking lot. I made it to the corner of the place. And I tried to make a phone call because I had the phone number of one of my coworkers who told me if I need anything, I could call her. So I tried to make the phone call, but the operator answered in English. And as I said, I didn't know a word in English, and I didn't know, you know, I didn't even know the U.S. money, you know, coins, dimes, or anything like that. And I didn't have any money with me. So I tried to make the phone call. It was Sunday, and not a lot of people were on the street. But to my surprise, I saw a walking person. I asked him for help. I asked him to dial the number. He dialed the number. My coworker answered and came and picked me up from the corner of that place. My coworker took me to a restaurant for the first time. I ate a real meal in the United States. And my friend was so happy because she thought she had helped me to gain my freedom. But the following morning when she went to work, my trafficker was forcing her to tell her where I was, because my trafficker was so sure that she's the one who helped me. So because of my trafficker's intervention, I had to look for another place where to go, and I went to San Diego.
And that's why you go to San Diego.
Oh, yeah, to escape trafficking.
Yeah.
So I wonder what that first American meal was, because if it's anything that you can buy in America, it was either Chinese food or Taco Bell.
I was going to say an In-N-Out burger. I mean, you know, what would you, like, you find out that your work buddy has been secretly trafficked for months and held against their will. Like, I don't know, I go get them some animal-style fries.
I might spend a little bit more money than that.
What, you're going
that says a lot about you.
But there's no water burgers here.
I feel like, man, if you escape human trafficking and I'm the first person you run into, we'll probably go eat someplace nice, like Vegas.
I was going to say Sizzler.
Oh, no.
You really live on a different scale, Brandon.
Listen, I don't want them to eat the same food they probably were already eating in the factory. God knows those cows got human trafficked, and then the people who chopped up those cows were human trafficked. I don't want them in the same industry at all.
You're right.
Yeah, they get a nice piece of meat from some place that has a French or Italian name.
I'm thinking Arby's.
And you're thinking beef.
So Floor was only in San Diego for a few days before the FBI caught up with her, which sounds like it might not be ideal, but actually it worked out pretty great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whew. Thanks to a good Samaritan who had tipped them and the intervention of the Coalition for Humane Immigrants' Rights of Los Angeles, CHIRLA, a coalition that intervenes or makes sure that immigrants' rights are respected. CHIRLA intervened and told them that they were calling them to advise them about the situation, that they received this call, that there were abuses at this workplace, but they wanted the workers' rights to be respected. So authorities brought me to Los Angeles and asked me to cooperate with them, because they told me all my coworkers were in the detention center and my trafficker was free, and my trafficker was blaming my coworker who helped me. My trafficker said that she didn't know me and I hadn't ever worked at her place. And the person who brought me over was my friend, the one that helped me. So authorities asked me to tell them who was who. So I decided to cooperate with law enforcement. But being Mexican, it was really, really difficult for me to testify or to help authorities telling them the truth, because being Mexican, we don't have really good experiences with law enforcement. And of course, adding the lies that my trafficker told me, that they will not believe me, instead they will put me in jail. Of course, I was really afraid of the authorities because I didn't know what to expect from them. But at the end, I decided to take the chance and tell them just exactly what happened and, you know, let them decide whether they let me stay in the United States or send me back home. But the good thing, after 30 interviews, they allowed me to stay in the United States.
Only 30 interviews.
Wow. That's the problem, is when the people who are the victims are also oppressed, it makes it very difficult to even help them in the first place. And in this case, immigrants and women are the people who are easiest to be preyed upon, because we already discriminate against those people even when they're legal or wealthy or, you know, doing okay.
Well, and it's like with Aisha, you can say to someone in her position, well, like, no, this guy, even though he has guns, like, if you tell the police on him, they're going to arrest him. He's not going to be able to do anything. He's not part of a network or whatever. But with these people, like, your family's back in Mexico. They're threatening your family. The FBI is not going to.
No.
They can't.
I noticed how the scam is different depending on the scam itself. So the only way to really pimp out an educated white woman is to be an even more educated white male who has a piece of the system. Mm-hmm. So the only way to pimp out people who are skilled laborers is to have access to somebody who has a factory. That's kind of the issue. You're like, wow, no matter where you look in class or in these different sectors of society, there's always some dude that wants to make money off some bullshit.
I mean, well, I told you I wasn't going to go on an anti-capitalist rant, but...
I mean, you know, the crazy thing is that capitalism has a little bit of craftsmanship in it. So a guy makes a table and he loves making tables.
Sure.
But that's why, like I said, I hate these hustles. Because it's like, yeah, you don't really like providing an experience where two people can have a consensual sexual experience. That's not what you're in the business for. You're straight up in the business for making money off of victims. Because I do believe, like you sort of mentioned, was like, yeah, some people want to go into prostitution. I just want to be in a society where it's a choice, where she was like, I could have been anything I wanted to be, or he says, I could have been anything I wanted to be, but I chose to do this because this is how I get my respect.
Yeah, and it's like, the garment industry doesn't need to be this way. Like, there's no need to, like, American Apparel, who we unfairly maligned earlier, treats their workers well, pays them, like, even when their workers aren't here, aren't documented, which I know they got in trouble with, they're at least paid well. And so, like, what the hell's the problem? Like, you want to wear nice clothing, there's nothing wrong with wearing clothing that people, like, there's nothing wrong with sewing for a living. A lot of people enjoy that.
Also, folks, there's a ton of clothing. There's so much clothing that the industries that support the recycling of clothing are themselves involved in the sweat trade. So, you know, you look at, like, a Goodwill, which underpays its employees based on the fact that they may be disabled, and then underpays some of their employees because they are part of court systems, because you can volunteer under the courts to work at a Goodwill or an Out of the Closet or Salvation Army if you have too many traffic tickets or if you've gotten a judgment from the court. So we have enough stuff that no one should be a slave to make more.
We do get kind of a happy ending with Flora's story, because at least this story has like a happy ending, you know? Like, Flora got to stay in the United States. She learned the shit out of some English, because her English is great, especially for someone who picked it up later in life. And her trafficker got some punishment. Not a lot, but not none.
Only 6 months of house arrest, a fine of $75,000. And that's it. She was judged as an abuser employer instead of trafficker. Because back then, human trafficking was kind of a new topic for law enforcement, so they didn't know how to judge my trafficker. And after my trafficker finished her house arrest, she went to Mexico and visited my family. And since then, she had contacted my family multiple times, forcing them to tell her where I am. And the last time I heard that she had contacted my family was in year 2008, when she went to visit my mother and give $20 to my mother for my mother to call her as soon as my mother find out where I was. So later on, she went to my brother's house and intimidated my brother for my brother to give her my address in the United States. So when I find out, I called my lawyer, and my lawyer later on contacted the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the U.S. Attorney's Office gave a call to my trafficker and told her to leave me alone.
I know we've hit pretty hard on the whole you wear stuff made from slaves angle in this podcast. Like, this isn't like a finger-waggling thing, because we're all equally guilty of, like, I think probably we're in, like, a big recording room now. I'm sure there's a ton of stuff on our mixing board that came from people who had to be forced at gunpoint to mine it. I mean, someone here's given somebody a diamond ring at some point. Oh, maybe not. Not
hey, man, when you black, you ain't really trying to give out blood diamonds.
And I'm just a shitty husband.
I mean, you know, a fake ring is going to work. I mean, I really want her to pull out the jeweler's eye and then get mad at me.
Yeah, but are you sure that fake ring wasn't mined by fake slaves?
That's a good point.
Yeah.
That's a good point. There's a lot of Oompa Loompas missing.
Yeah, fake De Beers. And just almost as bad as real De Beers. That is an important angle, because, like, all of the stuff that Flora made while she was being trafficked was sold in department stores here in the United States, like our currently very sick friend Sears.
And JCPenney, pretty sick.
Yeah.
Macy's not doing that well either.
Yeah, none of them doing great.
Because that's the thing, is there is a little bit of karma going on in the world. And there's also, you can see a business on its way down, it's going to try and do cost-cutting measures, and those cost-cutting measures are not going to be good.
And kind of one of the other pieces of good news that we have in this is that in sort of the wake of Flores' case, there was a bill passed that attempted to stop some of this shit from going on.
The dresses were sold in the department store here in the United States. I remember, you know, some names of the stores. And that's why, as a result of my experience, the SB 657, the Supply Chain Transparency Bill, was introduced and became a law in the United States. Because when I do public speaking, I always say that as consumers, we have a lot to say and we have a huge responsibility because we as consumers, we demand goods, we demand products. So if we ask big department stores what they are doing to prevent human trafficking in their supply chain, we are doing something to prevent human trafficking from the places where the goods are coming from.
I mean, unfortunately, though, it's still pretty common today, even among products that you wouldn't think, and not necessarily now in the sewing stage, but like think about Patagonia, which is like when you think about what 41-year-old liberal college professors wear on the weekends when they want to seem adventurous. It's their fucking Patagonia jackets and Patagonia pants, like hippie-friendly hiker clothes. They do a great job of making sure nobody who sews them is being trafficked, nobody who, like, sells them is being trafficked. They do their best. But back in 2015, a story broke that while Patagonia had done a great job of vetting to make sure that their factories, the people sewing their products, weren't being trafficked in any way, they hadn't done as thorough a check on the factories that made the raw fabrics. And it turned out that as many as a quarter of their raw fabrics suppliers had some evidence of human trafficking in their supply chain. And the story behind Patagonia's slavery scandal sounds a lot like Flora's story. And I'm quoting from an Atlantic article here with the title, "All Your Clothes Are Made with Exploited Labor," written by Jillian B. White. The story of the Patagonia trafficking controversy sounds a hell of a lot like Flora's story. And I'm reading the quote here from that article. "The problem stemmed from how those mills found the people to work their factory lines. They didn't hire workers themselves and instead turned to so-called labor brokers. These labor brokers charged migrants exorbitant, often illegally high fees in exchange for jobs. There were other red flags, too. Suppliers would open bank accounts into which the workers deposited their paychecks so that fees for labor brokers could be automatically deducted. Workers' movements were also restricted through the confiscation of passports. The recruitment and hiring process used by many labor brokers can create a cycle of fear and debt that leaves workers neither able to leave their jobs nor to make a decent living. Worldwide, there are 12.3 million slaves producing goods for the United States." That wasn't a quote from that article. That's just another fact.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's like kind of where we have to end here, is the point that as happy an ending as Flora's story has, because she got to stay in the United States, you know, she's got to go on and become an advocate, help to pass a bill that's hopefully reduced this kind of problem. You know, even right now, you know, within spitting distance of where we are today, one of the most cleanest reputation companies in the garment industry just was found with slavery in their production line. Like, there's no way to make sure that the clothing you buy doesn't have that somewhere. Because even if everything's being sewn and put together by, like, people who want to be there, who are doing a good job and getting paid fair wages, what about the fabrics? What right. about the machinery that makes the fabrics? Like,
it would be crazy to assume that the cotton industry, which was built on the backs of slavery, suddenly just decided to pay a fair wage some 250 years later.
Yeah. What is a fair wage for the kind of, like, when you look at the cotton industry, you look at all these farmers in India who have exorbitantly high suicide rates because of the chemicals they're forced to use that blind them and cause neurological problems. Well, that's not slavery because they're getting paid, but is it like a much more ethical to force people to do a job where they have to be blinded and crippled over the course of 5-10 years in order to keep their quotas up?
It's like, interesting because if you look at the NFL, they are having that same issue right now, which is, can you ask people to do things for money that will potentially injure them regardless? And I think that, yeah, you have an ethics across the board that says, I don't really want a shirt if a shirt is going to cost a kid an arm. Mm-hmm. I don't really want this car if the only way that we can get this technology is by short-circuiting somebody else's economy. And I think that's a fair thing to ask, because at the end of the day, we're trying to make things that are sustainable and high quality, and those two tend to go hand in hand. If you look at what rich people own, they don't own anything that has been made by poor people, because things made by poor people are garbage, and that's what makes it a crime. They drive cars that are handmade, Rolls-Royce, Bentley, Mercedes, because those companies put money and interest into those people. So what you want to, I think going forward, what you want to do is ensure that what you're buying is something that is going to be recycled, that has been recycled and doesn't really have a bloody trail to it. Might be a little bit more expensive, but what we know is that the things that you pay big money for, you don't replace.
Turn your Fords in for Bentleys, people.
Like, do something, people. Turn your Fords in. But you know what? Don't buy a garbage car because you know you're going to have to fix it. Buy something that may look like, it may not be the hottest looking thing, but it gets you to and from work. Don't do it out of trying to save money. Do it ethically.
Yeah, but also, like, to an extent, it's kind of impossible to be perfectly ethical. Because, like, Patagonia is one of those rich people clothing brands that you would have expected wouldn't have a problem.
But then if you're buying secondhand Patagonia from out of the closet, then what you know is you are not being taken advantage of because it was brand new. It's probably going to be in good shape because it's Patagonia and they hold up. And the money that you spend on it actually goes back into a charity. That's kind of the idea, is that you're creating this loop constantly if you're shopping high quality used, or if you're shopping high quality with the intent of getting real use out of it.
Harm reduction.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess that's kind of the best we can hope for. 12.3 million slaves making our stuff is try and give as little money to the companies doing that as possible. Try and buy as many things as possible that hold up after use. And don't shop at Sears.
Yeah. Industry will respond. What they'll notice is that we are asking for high quality goods, and they'll start to produce those high quality goods, and they'll respond to the fact that the people who work there brag about it. I mean, there was a time when people bragged about working for car companies because car companies gave great benefits and because they were proud of the product they made. We can always go back there.
Cracked Gets Personal has been produced by Robert Evans, Brett Rader, and Alex Schmidt. It was engineered and edited by Brett Rader. Next week on the show, three transgender women tell us about the difficulties of transitioning in the 1970s.
And yeah, I had very long hair at the time, but I sort of got away with that because if you were a computer engineer at that time, you got a big pass. Hiding in the rock and roll scene at night and hiding in the computer geek scene during the day, and, you know, getting a pass on both accounts.
For Robert Evans, I'm your host, Brandon Johnson. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening. Once again, we are sponsored by Big Grande's Teacher's Lounge, Season 1, completely free on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Earwolf, all of the places where you listen to podcasts and your mind is expanded. If you want to listen to more Big Grande's, head to Stitcher Premium. You can get Stitcher Premium for a month free if you go to stitcherpremium.com/teacher and use promo code PERSONAL. That's a pretty good deal, free. So take it and run with it like a bandit.
What is up? This is Andrew T., host of the Yo, Is This Racist podcast. If you need help dealing with your racist family, your racist coworkers, this is the podcast for you. Yes, even white people. This week, check out my episode with Brett Gelman and Janixa Bravo. They made a great movie called Lemon.
Yeah. I hate being in, like, white spaces where the hip-hop is playing super loud, and I'm like, I'm the only person of color here, and I know there's some... Yeah. I know there's some browns in the kitchen.
Yeah.
So it's like, if your front of the house is all white, you don't get hip hop.
Listen to Yo, Is This Racist on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. Peace.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.